Everyone loves to listen to a good book, and there are so many wonderful ones to choose, so we decided to bring you this podcast of Stories Come to Life. Each episode features a story from either classic or modern literature, especially chosen to be interesting and exciting to hear. So sit back, relax, and listen to this story come to life. Welcome to Stories Come to Life. I am your host, Catherine Lopez-Luker. After a wonderful long visit, Grandmama Sessaman has to go back to her own house. Heidi and Clara miss her, but soon there is something to distract everyone from her departure. The Sessaman house is haunted. Every morning, the front door is found to stand open, even though it has been double-locked every night. It takes Mr. Sessaman hurrying home from his business trip to solve the mystery. Now sit back, relax, and listen to this story come to life. Heidi, Chapter 11. Heidi improves in some ways and grows worse in others. Every afternoon during the whole of her visit, when Clara lay down for her nap, and Miss Rottenmeier was mysteriously absent, perhaps herself in need of rest, Grandmama settled down beside Clara for a moment. But before 5 minutes were gone, she would be up on her feet again, and would be calling Heidi into her room to chat with her, keep her busy in all sorts of ways, and entertain her. Grandmama had pretty little dolls, and showed Heidi how to make dresses and aprons for them. And almost before you knew it, the child had learned how to sew, and was making the finest dresses and cloaks for the little people. For the old lady had pieces of cloth of the most gorgeous colors. Now that Heidi could read, she was always asked to read some of her stories aloud to Grandmama. She loved to do this because the oftener she went over her tales, the dearer they grew to her. The things which happened to the storybook people were so real to Heidi that the bond between them was very close, and she was happy to spend her time in their companionship. Still, she never looked entirely happy, and her eyes no longer shone as gaily as they had formerly done. It was the last week that Grandmama was to spend in Frankfurt. She had just called for Heidi to come to her room, for it was the hour when Clara took her nap. As Heidi entered with her big book under her arm, Grandmama beckoned to her to come up close, laid the book aside, and said, "Now come, my dear, and tell me why you are not happy. Is it the same old trouble in your heart?" "Yes," said Heidi with a nod. "Did you take it to dear God in prayer?"
"Yes."
"And are you still praying every day that all will come right, and that God will give you joy?"
"Oh, no, I never pray any longer."
"What's that you say, Heidi? Why, what are you telling me? You really have stopped praying?"
"It's no use. The dear God paid no attention to me, and I really do believe," Heidi went on, "that when so many people in Frankfurt are praying all at the same time, of course the dear God can't hear what they all say, and he certainly did not listen to me."
"Indeed, and how can you be so sure of that, my dear?"
"I made the same prayer every day for many long weeks, and the dear God never answered it."
"That cannot happen, Heidi, and you must not think it can. Don't you see? The dear God is a loving father to us all, and he always knows what's best for us, even when we ourselves do not. Now, if we pray to him for something that is not good for us, he does not grant it. But if we keep on praying with all our heart and don't run right away and lose our trust in him, then he always gives us something better than we ask for."
"Why, I never thought of that," said Heidi.
"See, what you wanted him to grant you was not good for you at just that moment. Be sure that the dear God heard your prayer, because he can hear and see all people at the same time. That's why he is God, and not like you and me.
And because he knew perfectly what was good for you, he said to himself, "There's Heidi. Of course she must have what she asks for, but not until it's good for her, so she can get the most joy from it. For if I do what she wants right away, and she finds out later it would have been better for me not to do it, then she will weep and say, 'Oh, I wish the dear God had not given me what I asked him to. It isn't nearly as nice as I thought it would be.' And while the dear God was looking down from the sky to see if you really trusted him, and came every day to him and never failed to look to him when anything went wrong, why, you ran right away without trusting at all, and didn't pray and forgot the dear God entirely."
"I shouldn't have done that, should I, Grandmamma?"
"No, dear. For you see, when a person acts that way and the dear God never hears his voice raised in prayer, why, then he forgets that person too and lets him go out wherever he will. And when he is unhappy and cries out, 'There is no one to help me,' then we have no pity for that person but say to him, 'It was you who ran away from the dear God who could have helped you.' Do you want that to be said of you, Heidi? Or do you want to go this minute to the dear God and tell him you are sorry you turned away from him? Will you tell him that you will pray every day and trust him to do what is best for you, so that your heart can be happy again?"
Heidi had listened very carefully. Each word of Grandmamma's had gone straight to her heart, because she had such perfect trust in her.
"I will go this minute and ask the dear God to forgive me, and I will never forget him again," Heidi said, truly sorry.
"That's right, my dear. And you may be sure he will always help you when the time comes," Grandmamma said.
Heidi ran across to her room at once and prayed earnestly to the dear God, asking him not to forget her but to look down on her again in pity. The last day of Grandmamma's stay had come, and it was a day of sorrow to Clara and Heidi. But up to the very moment when she rode off in her carriage, Grandmamma succeeded in managing things so that the children scarcely felt the sadness of the day, but looked upon it rather as a time of rejoicing. But when she had finally gone, then the house seemed as empty and quiet as if the world had come to an end. Clara and Heidi sat around for the rest of the day, as if lost, and had no idea what was going to happen next. The following day, when the lessons were over, and it was the usual time for the children to sit together, Heidi came to Clara with her book under her arm and said,
"After this, I'm always going to read aloud to you. Would you like to have me?"
Clara said that this suited her exactly, and so Heidi began her new duties at once. But it was not long before there came a sudden end to things, because Heidi had scarcely begun to read a story which told how a grandmother was dying, when she suddenly screamed,
"Oh, now Grandmother is dead!"
She broke down and cried, for she thought everything she read about was actually taking place. And so she firmly believed that the grandmother on the mountain meadow had died. Her cries grew louder and louder.
"Now Grandmother is dead, and I can never go to see her again, and she didn't get a single other roll from me."
Clara tried as hard as she could to show Heidi that the story was not talking about the old lady on the mountain meadow, but about another grandmother entirely. But even after Clara had finally succeeded in explaining to the excited Heidi her mistake, the child could not be quieted and kept weeping harder than ever, for the awful thought had suddenly come to her that Grandmother might die anyway, while she was so far away from her, and perhaps her grandfather would die too, and then after a long time, when she should go home again, the mountain pasture would be still as death, and she would be there all alone, and could never again see her dear ones. In the meantime, Miss Rottenmeier had come into the room, and heard Clara trying to explain to Heidi her mistake. When she saw that the child could still not stop her sobbing, she went up to the two girls with evident impatience and said crossly,
"Adelheid, that's enough of your silly screaming. I want to tell you something.
If ever again, while reading your stories, you give way to such a fit of crying, I'll take your book and never hand it back to you." That worked. Heidi grew pale with fear. The book was her dearest possession. She dried her tears in great hurry and choked down her sobs as hard as she could and did not utter another peep. The housekeeper's threat had its effect. Heidi never wept again, no matter what she read. Sometimes she had to try so hard to conquer her sobs and not cry out that Clara would say to her in great surprise, "Why, Heidi, you're making the most awful faces I ever saw." But Heidi's faces did not make any noise, and therefore did not disturb Lady Rottenmeier. And after Heidi had got the best of her dreadful fit of grief, everything would go on as before, and her grief would soon be forgotten. With it all, however, Heidi so lost her appetite, and looked so thin and pale, that Sebastian could hardly bear to look on in silence and see how the child at dinner let the nicest dishes pass by untouched. So when he passed her a dish, he would often whisper encouragingly to her, "Take some of this, little mamselle. It is excellent. Oh, not such a small helping. Take a large spoonful of it, and then another one." Much similar fatherly advice he gave her. But it did no good. She no longer ate much of anything, and when at night she lay on her pillow, like a flash everything at home came to her eyes. She would then be so homesick that she wept on her pillow, but quite softly, so that it would disturb no one. In this way a long time passed. Heidi herself never had an idea whether it was summer or winter, for the walls that she saw from the windows of the Sesemann house never seemed to change. She went out of doors only when Clara was feeling well and could be taken for a drive in the carriage. And this was always a short drive, because Clara was not strong enough to go very far. So they seldom got beyond the paved streets and walls of the town, but usually turned around and kept driving through the broad, beautiful city streets, where there were to be seen plenty of houses and people, but no grass, and no flowers, no fir trees, and no mountains. Heidi's longing for the natural object she had been used to grew greater every day. If some chance word brought up the memory of one of these things, it was all Heidi could do to bear the pain which came to her, and she had to struggle with all her might not to show her unhappiness. So autumn and winter passed by, and once again the sun was shining so glaringly on the white walls of the houses across from her that Heidi guessed the time was drawing near when Peter drove the goats up to the mountain pasture. The rock roses would again be gleaming in the sunlight, and every evening the mountain roundabout would stand in flames. Poor Heidi! She would sit down in a far corner of her lonely room and hold both hands to her eyes, so she could not see the sunshine on the wall over across from her. And thus would she sit without moving, silently fighting down her burning homesickness, until Clara called for her again. Chapter 12. The Sesemann House is Haunted. For some days, Miss Rottenmeier had been wandering around the house, for the most part silently, wrapped in thought. Whenever along about twilight she walked from one room to another, or down the long hall, she would often look about her, into the corners, or steal a quick glance behind her now and then, as if she thought someone might be following her on tiptoe, to pull unseen at her skirt. But when she was alone, she went only into the lighted living rooms. Now sometimes at dusk she had things to attend to on the upper floor, where the beautifully furnished guest rooms were located, or she would have an errand, perhaps downstairs, in the great mysterious reception hall, in which every footstep echoed back from afar. And the old counselors, with their big white rough collars, looked down from their frames with so stern and unchanging a gaze. At such a time, Miss Rottenmeier would regularly ring for Tinette and tell the maid she must come along, pretending there might be some bit of furniture to be carried up or down. Strangely enough, Tinette did just the same thing. If she had any work to do upstairs or down, she would call for Sebastian and tell him to go with her, for she might have something to shift about which she could not manage alone. What was even more funny, Sebastian himself went through exactly the same performance. If he was sent to one of the more distant rooms, he fetched Johann and made him go along for fear he alone would not be strong enough to carry what was needed. And each one of them was always glad to answer the other's call, although there never was anything really to be carried, and each might just as well have gone alone. But it looked as if the companion always figured that he might soon have need of the other for a similar service. And while these strange doings were going on upstairs, down in her kitchen the cook, who had been with Mr. Sesemann for many years, would stand among her pots and pans, shake her head and sigh, "That I should live to see this day." For a long time there had been something strange going on in the Sesemann house. Each morning when the servants came downstairs, they found the front door open. And yet, far and near, there was no one to be seen who could be blamed for the fact. The first days that this happened, all the rooms and closets of the house were eagerly searched to discover what might have been stolen, for it was thought a thief might have hidden himself in the house and escaped with his booty later in the night. But this was evidently not the state of the case, for not a single thing in the whole house was missing. At night, the door was now not only double locked, but the wooden bar was also placed across it. It made no difference. In the morning, the door stood wide open. No matter how early in the morning the servants in their excitement might come trooping down, there was the door ajar. And yet, there was the whole neighborhood still sunk in deep sleep, and the windows and the doors of all the other houses were still tightly bolted. At last, Johann and Sebastian got up their courage and prepared to spend the night below in the room that opened off the great hall, there to await whatever might happen. Lady Rottenmeier hunted out several of Mr. Sesemann's firearms and gave Sebastian a large bottle of brandy so that they might feel strong enough to put up a brave fight with the robber, if it should be necessary. The two servants took their places on the appointed evening, and at once began to drink a little brandy for the sake of their strength. This made them first talkative, and afterward very sleepy, whereupon they both leaned back in their chairs and dozed. When the old clock in the tower across the way struck midnight, Sebastian gathered himself together and called out to his comrade. But Johann was not easily wakened. Every time Sebastian called him, he would turn his head from one side of the chair back to the other and pass off to sleep again. Sebastian, however, now began to listen eagerly, for he was by this time as wide awake as he could be. It was as still as death about him. There was not a single sound to be heard, even from the street. You may believe that Sebastian did not go to sleep again, because there was a queer feeling in the deep silence about him, and it was in low tones that he kept calling to Johann, and he shook him a little from time to time. Finally, when it struck 1 o'clock, up above there, Johann woke up and came to realize clearly why he was sitting up in a chair and not lying safely in his bed. Suddenly he started up quite bravely and cried out, "Well, Sebastian, we must have a look out in the corridor and see how things are. Don't be afraid, you just follow me." The door to the hall was slightly ajar. Johann threw it wide open and left the room. At the same moment, a strong gust of air from the open entrance door blew in and put out the candle that Johann was holding in his hand. The servant started back and almost upset Sebastian, who was standing right behind him. Then he dragged his companion back into the room that they had just left, slammed the door shut, and in great haste turned the key in the lock as far as it would go. Then he got out his matches and lighted his candle again. Sebastian did not know just what had happened, because standing behind Johann's broad back, he had not felt the draft of air so plainly. But as soon as he could see Johann's face in the light, he uttered a frightened cry. Johann was as white as chalk, and trembling like a leaf.
"What's wrong? Tell me, what was that outside?" Sebastian asked anxiously.
"The door was standing wide open," Johann panted, "and on the steps there was a white figure.
Look, Sebastian, right up the stairs like that, swish!"
and vanished into thin air. Cold shivers ran down the length of Sebastian's back. Then the two servants sat down as close to each other as they could, and they didn't move a muscle until bright daylight had come, and people were again stirring about out on the street. Then together they left the room, closed the front door, which was still standing wide open, and went upstairs to report to Miss Rottenmeier what had happened. Early as the hour was, they found this lady all ready to receive them, because she had not slept a wink for thinking of what might be going on downstairs. The moment she learned what had happened, she sat down and wrote a letter to Mr. Sessman, one such as he had never received before, and probably never would again. She began it by saying that she was so afraid she could not move her fingers. She asked Mr. Sessman to pack his belongings without a moment's delay and come straight home, for the most unheard of things were happening there. Then she told just what had occurred. The front door was open regularly every morning. Everyone in the house was in danger of his life, with the door ajar the whole night through, and what the terrible results of this strange situation might be, none could say. Now Mr. Sessman answered by return mail that it was impossible for him to close up his business so suddenly and come home. The ghost story surprised him greatly, but he hoped it would be a thing of the past before his letter was received. Meanwhile, if the ghost refused to be laid, Miss Rottenmeier would do well to write Mrs. Sessman and ask her if she would not come to Frankfurt to their assistance. His mother would surely get rid of the ghost so fast that they would never again dare disturb the quiet of his home. Miss Rottenmeier was not the least bit pleased at the tone of this letter. She took the matter of the ghost too seriously to enjoy such teasing. She wrote at once to Mrs. Sessman, but she got no better results here either, for the old lady's reply contained some very plain words. For example, she said, she had no intention of making a special trip from Holstein to Frankfurt, just because Rottenmeier saw ghosts. What was more, a ghost had never been seen in the Sessman house, and if such a thing was wandering there now, it couldn't possibly be anything more than a human being, and Rottenmeier should settle with it at once. If this were impossible, she might call in the night policeman to help her. But Miss Rottenmeier had made up her mind to spend no more days of terror, and she knew how to help matters. Until this moment, she had said nothing to the two children about the ghost, for she was afraid they would be so scared that they would not want to stay alone a single minute, night or day, and that would cause her a great deal of extra trouble. Now, however, she went straight to the study where the two were sitting together, and in a low tone of voice, she told them about the unknown creature who walked around the house every night. Clara, of course, cried out at once that she would not stay alone another second, that Papa must come home, that Miss Rottenmeier must move over into her room to sleep, and that Heidi must not be left alone either, or the ghost would get in and do harm to her. She wanted them all to stay in the same room and leave a light burning all night. And Tinette must sleep next door, and Sebastian and Johann must come down too and spend the night in the hall, so that they could scream and scare away the ghost if it got to coming down the steps. Clara was terribly excited. It was all that Miss Rottenmeier could do to quiet her. The housekeeper promised to write to her papa at once, to bring her own bed into Clara's room, and never to leave her alone again. Still, she said, they could not all sleep in a single room. And if Adelheid was afraid, then Tinette must put up a couch beside her. But Heidi was more afraid of Tinette than she was of ghosts, because she had never even heard of such a creature, and she said, therefore, that she wasn't afraid of any ghost, and would much sooner stay in her place by herself. No sooner was this decided than Lady Rottenmeier ran to her writing-desk and reported to Mr. Sessman that the strange things which were going on every night in the house were having such an effect on the delicate health of his daughter that no one could tell what awful results there might be. She had known of cases where terrible fits resulted from such conditions. His daughter was exposed to any sort of misfortune if her state of terror should last much longer. This second letter stirred things up. 2 days later, Mr. Sessman stood before the door of his house and pulled so hard on the bell that people came running from all directions and stared at each other open-mouthed, for they were sure that the evil spirit was now beginning to play his wicked jokes without waiting for night to come. From the second story, Sebastian carefully peered down through the crack in a window blind, but just then there was another ring at the bell, so full of impatience that no one could doubt any longer that it was a living hand behind the powerful jerk. Sebastian recognized whose hand it was, ran pell-mell out of the room and down the stairs, and managed to land on his feet long enough to tear open the front door. Mr. Sessman nodded quickly to him, but without a single word of greeting to him, started upstairs for his daughter's room. Clara welcomed her father with a cry of joy, and when he saw her looking as well and happy as usual, the frown of worry left his brow, and his face cleared. He heard from his daughter's own lips that she was perfectly well, and just as glad as could be that he had come back to her. She even said that she was now fond of the ghost who was haunting the house, because it had made her papa run home to her.
"How is the ghost behaving, Miss Rottenmeier?" Mr. Sessman asked, while the corners of his mouth twitched with amusement.
"Ah, Mr. Sessman," the housekeeper replied very seriously, "it is nothing to smile at. I doubt if Mr. Sessman himself will laugh at it tomorrow, for something is going on in this house that points to an awful crime of the past, which has long been kept secret."
"Well, I know nothing about that," Mr. Sessman said. "But please don't begin to think badly of my poor ancestors. Call Sebastian into the dining room, won't you? I want to say a word to him in private."
Mr. Sessman went across the hall, and Sebastian made his appearance. His employer knew that Sebastian and the housekeeper were not on the best of terms, so he was suspicious.
"Come here, you rogue," as he waved to the servant to enter, "and see that you are quite honest with me. Haven't you yourself been playing the part of a ghost a little, just to make things lively for Miss Rottenmeier, eh?"
"No, sir, on my honor, I haven't. Please believe me, sir, I haven't felt at all right about the matter myself," Sebastian answered with evident honesty.
"Well, if that's the way you feel, I'll have to show you and that brave Johann tomorrow how a ghost looks in the daytime. Be ashamed of yourself, Sebastian. A strong young fellow like you running away from ghosts. Now go straight to my old friend, Dr. Clausen. Give him my greetings and ask him to please come to the house at 9 o'clock this evening, without fail. Tell him I've come home from Paris especially to consult him. Say I'm so badly off he'll have to spend the night with me. He must arrange things so that he can. You understand, Sebastian?"
"Of course, sir. Rely upon it, sir."
Sebastian departed. Mr. Sessman went back to his little daughter to quiet her fears about the ghost. He promised that he would clear the matter up that very day. Promptly at 9 o'clock, after the children had gone to bed, and Miss Rottenmeier had retired for the night, the doctor arrived. In spite of his gray hairs, he had a very young-looking face, and two eyes with a friendly twinkle in their depths. At first he seemed to be quite anxious, but the moment his friend greeted him, he broke out into a hearty laugh, clapped the pretended invalid on the shoulder, and said,
"Well, I must say, old man, that for a sick person who needs sitting up with, you look fairly healthy."
"You just wait, my dear fellow," Mr. Sessman replied. "The one you're sitting up for will look worse than I do when once we've caught him."
"So you have a sick man in the house, and one who has to be caught into the bargain?" "Worse than that, Doctor, far worse. We have a ghost in the house. We're haunted."
The doctor laughed out loud.
"Oh, a lot of sympathy you have, Doctor," Mr. Sessman said. "It's a pity my friend Lady Rottenmeier cannot be here to enjoy it. She firmly believes that some old Sessman is wandering about because of some secret deed of violence."
"How did she make the ghost's acquaintance, do you suppose?"
the doctor asked, still greatly amused. Mr. Sessman then proceeded to tell his friend about the whole affair, how, according to the testimony of all the people in the house, the front door swung wide every night. He said further that just to be prepared for anything that might happen, he had had 2 loaded revolvers put in the place where they were to watch. For the whole business might, of course, prove to be only a poor joke, which someone of the servants' friends was playing, in order to frighten the people in the house while the master was away. In that case, it might be a good idea to scare the ghost by shooting off a pistol. Or, on the other hand, thieves might be mixed up with the affair, who had been first passing themselves off as ghosts, so that later they would be safe from anyone's interfering with them. In that case, a good weapon would not be out of place. While Mr. Sessman was thus explaining things to the doctor, they went downstairs to the same room in which Johann and Sebastian had sat to watch. On the table lay the 2 revolvers, and in the center stood 2 brightly lighted candelabra, for the master of the house did not want to await the coming of the ghost in half darkness. They closed the door all but the merest crack, because too much light must not shine out into the hall, or the ghost might be frightened away. Then the gentlemen sat down comfortably in their armchairs and fell to talking about all sorts of things, now and then taking a sip of the wine which Sebastian had brought for their refreshment. And so, before they realized how time was passing, the clock struck 12.
"The ghost knows we're here and probably won't come tonight after all," the doctor suggested.
"You just wait. They say it does not appear until 1 o'clock, his friend replied.
They went on with their talking. 1 o'clock struck. There was a deep silence all around them. The sounds of the street outside had died away. Suddenly, the doctor made a warning gesture.
"Shh! Sessman, don't you hear something?"
They both listened intently. Softly, and yet quite distinctly in the silence, they heard the sound of the bar as it was pushed back. The key was turned twice in the lock. The door was being opened. Mr. Sessman reached out for his revolver.
"You're not afraid, surely," the doctor said, rising. "You can't be too careful," Mr. Sessman whispered.
He seized a holder with 3 candles in his left hand and a revolver in his right. Then he followed the doctor out of the room into the hall. The pale rays of the moon streamed in through the widely open door and lighted up a white figure that was standing quite still on the threshold.
"Who's there?"
bellowed the doctor so loudly that the sound rang down the long hall. Both of the men started toward the figure with lights and weapons waving. It turned on them, and Heidi! There stood Heidi, with bare feet, in her white nightdress, blinking at the bright flames of the candles and at the firearms, shaking and trembling from top to toe like a small leaf in the wind. The men looked at her in the greatest astonishment.
"I honestly believe, Sessman, it's the little girl who carries water to you," the doctor said. "My child, "What does this mean?" Mr. Sessman asked after a moment's pause. "What were you after? Why did you come down here?"
Pale with fright, Heidi stood before him and answered weakly, "I don't know."
Then the doctor took a hand in what was going on. "Sessman," he said, "this is a case for me to deal with. Go in the other room and sit down for a while in the easy chair. First of all, I'll take the child back where she belongs." With these words, he laid his revolver down on the floor, took the shivering child's hand in his, and went off upstairs with her.
"Just don't you be afraid of anything," he said kindly, as they climbed slowly up the steps. "But we must be quiet, so as not to wake people. Don't worry, nothing bad has happened."
When they were in Heidi's room, the doctor set his candlestick upon the table. He lifted Heidi up and put her in bed. He covered her carefully, and then he sat down in a chair by her side and waited until she was a little quieter and no longer shook so terribly. He put his hand on hers and said,
"There we are. Everything's all right again. Now suppose you tell me where you were trying to go."
"I wasn't trying to go anywhere, of course," Heidi assured him, "and I didn't go down there either. I just found myself down there all of a sudden."
"Oh, I see. Do you know if you were having a dream that made you see and hear things just as plain as day?"
"Yes, I have a dream every night, and it's always the same one. Then I think I'm back at Grandfather's, for I hear the fir trees rustling out of doors, and I say to myself, 'Now the stars are gleaming so brightly up in the sky.' Then I run fast and open the door of the hut, and oh, it is so beautiful there. But when I wake up, I'm always back in Frankfurt."
Heidi began to twist about and to swallow down the lump that somehow would rise in her throat.
"Aha! And do you ever feel any pain anywhere? In your head or in your back?"
"Oh, no. There's just something that presses here all the time. Sort of like a big stone."
"I see. Sort of as if you've eaten something bad for you, and then you wish you could get rid of it again?"
"No, not like that. But it feels so heavy, as if you had to cry hard."
"Oh, that's the way it feels. And do you ever go and cry hard?"
"Oh, no. I'm afraid to cry. Miss Rottenmeier said I mustn't."
"Then you just swallow it down again like this, don't you? That's good. Do you like to live here in Frankfurt very much?"
"Oh, yes," was the low answer. But it sounded more as if she meant really just the opposite.
And where were you living with your grandfather?"
"Always up on the mountain meadow."
"I see. But it isn't such awfully good fun there, is it? Isn't it sometimes pretty dreary?"
Oh my, no. You can't think of how nice it is there."
Heidi could not go on. The thought of her dear mountain home, the excitement she had just passed through, the weeping she had been holding back so long, these things got too strong for her. The tears began to flow from her eyes in a perfect stream, and she broke out into loud and violent sobbing. The doctor got up from his chair. He laid Heidi's head gently down on its pillow and said,
"There, now you can go ahead and cry a little. That won't hurt anybody. Then have a nice, fine sleep. Tomorrow, everything will be all right."
Then the doctor stole from the room. When he was down again in the room where they had kept watch, he settled into an armchair across from his waiting friend and explained things to him. Mr. Sessman listened with eager attention.
"First of all," he said, "your little girl walks in her sleep. Without knowing it, she has opened your front door every night like a ghost and scared your servants within an inch of their lives. Next, the child is pining away with homesickness and has lost flesh until she is almost a skeleton. If you're not careful, she will really be one.
Something must be done in a hurry. There is only one cure for her first trouble, and for the bad state of her nerves. Send the child back to the pure air of her mountain home. There is only one cure for her second trouble, and that is to do the very same thing. So you have my prescription. The child goes home tomorrow.
Mr. Sessamon jumped up from his chair. He walked up and down the room in great excitement. Finally, he broke out.
Nonsense! Walking in her sleep? Sick? Longing to be back home? Getting to be a skeleton? And all this in my house? Without anybody's noticing it or suspecting it in the least? The child came to my house happy and healthy, Doctor. Do you think I'm going to send her back to her grandfather's, wretched and thin as a rail? No, Doctor, that's too much to expect. I can't do it, and I never shall. You take the child in hand. Treat her. Do anything you want, but make her healthy and sound for me again. Then I'll send her home if that's what she wants. But first I must have your help.
Sessamon, the doctor answered earnestly, just remember what you are doing. Her sickness is not one that can be cured with powders and pills. The child is not very strong, but if you send her back at once to the bracing mountain air she is used to, she will probably get entirely well. But even suppose she doesn't, you don't want to send her home to her grandfather too late to be cured, do you? Or perhaps never send her home at all?
Mr. Sessamon stood still, terrified.
Why, if that's what you think, Doctor, then there's only one thing to do, and we must get right to work.
With these words, Mr. Sessamon put his arm in that of his friend and walked up and down with him while they talked the matter over further. Then the doctor started for home, because their talk had lasted a good while. The bright morning light streamed in through the front door, which this time was opened by the master of the house. This is your host, Catherine Lopez-Luker. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Stories Come to Life. Be sure to join us next time when we continue to listen to Heidi. I'd love to hear your suggestions for future stories, so please send an email to me at kluker@marshallpl.org. I'll talk to you again soon.